Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, a deadly surge. India suffers hundreds of thousands of new infections of COVID-19, overwhelming hospitals and burial grounds across the country. Then, making it count. The results of the latest census are released, potentially altering the future balance of power in Washington. And major changes. Questions remain as the Biden administration ends the Remain in Mexico policy for refugees seeking legal asylum at the southern border.
None of these families have actually won their asylum claim. All of them are in immigration proceedings, and a good number of them are going to face deportation at some date in the future.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. India is in crisis tonight as COVID-19 infections pass 350,000 a day, with more than 2,800 deaths. The Biden administration says that it will send a range of help to India and will share up to 60 million doses of AstraZeneca vaccine with other nations. We'll return to India after the news summary. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed today to new arguments on the right to carry a gun in public. It will be the first such case since Justice Amy Coney Barrett gave conservatives a 6-3 majority. At issue is whether New York State's gun permit law violates the Second Amendment. The U.S. Justice Department is launching a full-scale review of police tactics in Louisville, Kentucky. It comes a year after police shot and killed Breonna Taylor during a raid at her home. Chief Erica Shields said today that her force welcomes the investigation.
They want to get it right. They want the community to be proud of them. And so what I look at this as an opportunity to quicken the pace in which we can make those changes essential so that the community trusts us and believes in us.
The police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis prompted a similar Justice Department announcement last week. Such investigations were sharply curtailed during the Trump years. In Turkey, more than 100 people associated with a pro-Kurdish political party went on trial today over mass protests in 2014. Prosecutors claim the defendants organized and incited violence. The Kurds say that it is the latest step in an ongoing crackdown on them. The president of Turkey today rejected President Biden's decision to label the killings of Armenians during World War I as genocide. Recep Tayyip Erdogan called the move unfounded, but he said he hopes that the two NATO allies can still work together.
We now need to put aside the issues that poison the relations between the two countries and look at what steps we can take from now on. Otherwise, we will have no choice but to do what is required by the level our ties have fallen to.
All told, an estimated 1.5 million Armenians died in deportations and massacres starting in 1915. They were living in the Ottoman Empire, the precursor to what is now Turkey. A leaked interview with Iran's top diplomat caused a stir today. Among other things, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that Russia had wanted to stop Iran's 2015 nuclear deal. He also criticized Qasem Soleimani, the late Revolutionary Guard commander, for pressing military gains over diplomacy. Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike in 2020. Back in this country, the Census Bureau announced that the U.S. population topped 331 million in the 2020 count. That is up 7.4% from the 2010 census, the second smallest increase ever. The numbers also show Republican-run states in the South and the West are gaining more congressional seats. We'll have a detailed look later in the program. And on Wall Street, blue chips slipped, but the rest of the market hit new highs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 62 points to close at 33,981. The NASDAQ rose 122 points to a record close, and the S&P 500 added just 7 points, but also finished at a new high. Still to come on the NewsHour, India suffers hundreds of thousands of new infections of COVID-19. The Biden administration ends the Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers, but struggles to deal with a massive backlog. What we learn from the latest critical census results, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
India is in a dire COVID crisis, while the Biden administration pledged to share tens of millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine with India and other countries. That vaccine still must be approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and those doses will not arrive in India for some time. The country is breaking new records daily. Today, India reported more than 350,000 new cases and 2,800-plus deaths. Many experts believe those numbers substantially undercount the true impact. In a moment, William Brangham talks with one of those experts. But let's begin with a report from John Ray of Independent Television News.
Death and grief. In India, both are now on heartbreaking public display. Where a son begs for his father's body to be taken to the crematorium for his last rites. Where the virus has returned at such speed, it has far outpaced this country's ability to cope. Sunita mourns for her brother, just 45 years old. COVID is claiming ever younger victims. He was a hospital worker in Patna, where patients lie in makeshift wards, where every life hangs by the slender thread of an oxygen tube, in a land where oxygen is just one more fatal shortage. It breeds panic and fuels soaring black market prices. We met the family of Sanjeev Kumar. He's struggling to breathe in the back of this car. They've finally secured oxygen for him, but it proves to be too late. We have driven here and there and everywhere to find help, says his brother Rajiv. Their mother cannot be consoled. If we'd had oxygen in time, he would have survived, he says, but the hospital couldn't give him any.
Our Indian healthcare system is in crisis. I would say that. We are short of oxygen, we are short of normal beds, ventilators, for that sake medicine. So there is an overall deterioration in all the sectors.
And in the country that is home to the world's biggest manufacturer of vaccine, too often there is none. In Mumbai today, crowds queued for precious doses with little regard to safe social distancing. Aid from overseas, ventilators and machines to make oxygen will arrive tomorrow. It can't come too soon for this young woman, denied a bed at a hospital in Delhi and left instead to the care of her family on the pavement outside. This is a nation in shock, crying out for help.
That report was from John Ray of Independent Television News. Let's talk a little bit more about India's crisis and what the U.S. might do to help. I'm joined again by Dr. Ashish Jha. He is the Dean of Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, always great to have you back on the NewsHour. We heard a young doctor in that report describe how the system, the overall deterioration in every sector of India's public health system. You've said that the medical system there is on the brink of collapse. What might that look like if that were to happen?
Yeah, William, this is a very difficult situation that India finds itself in. You know, there's been chronic underinvestment both in the healthcare and the public health systems of India. It was not ready to cope with a crisis of this size. And what that means is that hospital beds are running out, doctors and nurses are getting infected at alarming rates. And obviously that means that for people who have COVID, there's no place to get care, but it's also a tragedy for everybody else who needs healthcare. If you have a heart attack or a stroke or get into a car accident, there really isn't a recourse. It's a system that's on the brink of collapsing, and it's going to have huge health effects and other types of effects for a long period of time.
And if, as you and others have argued, that India's already astronomically high number of infections is an undercount, those stressed out hospitals haven't even seen the worst of it yet.
That's what I'm worried about. I think that there is not yet a realization, certainly among Indian policymakers, that this is not turning around quickly. One of the things we learned from all the surges in the United States is you see infections rise and hospitalizations follow 7 to 10 days later, and deaths follow a couple of weeks after that. India is still seeing increasing numbers of infections. Hospitalizations are going to continue rising, and the problem, of course, is there are no hospital beds. And the wave of patients will continue. And unless we expand capacity substantially, those patients will have no place to go.
I mean, we spent a long time dissecting what went wrong with the US's response and what cost so many lives here. Do you have a good sense of how India got to today? Meaning, could this have been prevented?
It absolutely could have been prevented. And it is frustrating to watch what happened because in so many ways, the government of India made exactly the same mistakes that other countries, including ours, made last year. You know, numbers of infections had come way down by January or early February, and there was a sense that India had somehow beaten COVID. But when the infection started rising again, partly because things opened up, the government had large political rallies. There was the Kumbh Mela, which is a major religious festival where millions of people came together in one city. And infection numbers were rising and there was denial. And it was only when it was no longer possible to deny the flood of very, very sick patients that the government has come to acknowledge that this really is a crisis. But many of us have been watching this for months, for the last 2 months, and trying to sound the alarm, but unfortunately it has not been met with an effective response.
So the US in the last 2 days has announced it's going to try to help out in some ways. It's going to release some of this AstraZeneca vaccine that we have been sitting on, although that may take months to get to India. It's going to help them with oxygen supplies, some therapeutics, some personal protective gear. These are all things that you argued that the US should have been doing. Do you think those steps will help in a substantial way?
I do. I mean, of course, the size of the problem is enormous, and no one country, not even the United States alone, can do it. But the United Kingdom, Germany, the Saudis, others have also stepped up to offer help. India has a lot of internal capacity that it can also start mobilizing. All of this put together, I really do think can make a substantial difference. But everybody needs to be pitching in right now. The size of India's problem is really astronomical, and no one person, no one country alone is going to be able to solve this.
I mean, there's obviously a moral case to be made for why we should help a country in such dire straits. But there's also, given the way that these variants are spreading, there's also a public health case to be made that we need to help everyone get a handle on this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's always worth remembering is this is a global pandemic. And things that happen in one place spread quickly. You know, if you just think about the variants that have arisen out of South Africa or Brazil or the UK, they're all here in the United States. And then we've seen new variants out of India. They're also in the United States. And this is the reality of a globalized world. So there are many, many reasons to help India, certainly a moral one, certainly a geopolitical one. But also the simple fact that you've got a lot of opportunities for infections in India, a lot of potential for more mutations, more variants, and that makes the world less safe. So whatever your reason for engaging, I think the key here is we all have to engage and bring the infection numbers way down.
Lastly, Ashish, the 10 Democratic senators have urged the Biden administration to waive temporarily the intellectual property rights for certain vaccines. We know that Prime Minister Modi mentioned this to President Biden today. Do you think that would help if we loosened those restrictions to allow other people to make more vaccine? Would that help India today?
You know, I think the intellectual property issue is important. It certainly is part of it. But I worry, William, that We're getting distracted by this. This is not the biggest constraint. If we relax all IP rights right now, I don't think it would add much in the way of vaccines to the global supply. What we really need is technology transfer. What we need is to build out capacity. Vaccines are hard things to make. And the intellectual property is not the biggest thing holding us back. There's a lot of other work that I think the Biden administration should absolutely be taking on and expanding capacity. So I want to relax those IP standards, but I don't want to think that that somehow is going to solve these issues.
All right, Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
In February, President Biden announced plans to wind down Remain in Mexico, the name given to the Trump administration policy that forced tens of thousands of legal asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while immigration courts considered their cases. But thousands of people seeking asylum are still waiting in Mexico, and even those who've been allowed into the U.S. have an uncertain future. Amna Nawaz has our report from El Paso, Texas.
After years of waiting in Mexico, these asylum seekers' first stop in the U.S. is here in El Paso, Texas. Among them, 40-year-old H from Guatemala. We're using just her first initial to protect her. She told me how difficult her journey had been.
Muy difícil.
H was among the thousands of people stuck in MPP, the Migrant Protection Protocol program. Launched by former President Trump, it forced people seeking asylum to remain in Mexico while their court cases unfolded in the U.S. Those cases ground to a halt in the pandemic, leaving H and her teenage son, who fled gang violence, stranded in Ciudad Juarez.
Did you have any idea when you'd be allowed to come to the U.S.?
No. Not really. They only told us that if we wanted to enter, we'd go to court. They'd give us the date on when to be there and return. That was the expectation of us.
But in February, President Biden prioritized 25,000 active MPP cases for processing, trying to wind down his predecessor's policy.
I make no apologies for ending programs that did not exist before Trump became president, that have an incredibly negative impact on the law, international law, as well as on human dignity.
H was among those cases. She was screened by U.S. officials, tested for COVID, and brought to this shelter in Texas. But she arrived alone. A year earlier, she tells us her teenage son decided he couldn't wait in limbo anymore and decided to cross the border on his own without telling her.
How long was it before you knew that he'd safely made it into the U.S.?
For 3 days, I didn't know anything. He was alone, all on his own, only 17, just a kid.
Ruben Garcia is the director here at Annunciation House, a volunteer shelter network that offers support to refugees and migrants. He's done this work for 40 years and recently met with Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on his visit to El Paso. Garcia says he welcomes Biden's unwinding of MPP, which he calls so far very orderly. Every day he receives about 120 people with MPP cases at his shelter.
When they first arrive, they're desperate to get to their families and to say, this part is now over. And for many of them, it's been a nightmare because they've had to learn to survive in a foreign environment, in an environment where there is a certain level of risk and danger.
But he warns there is still a long, uncertain road ahead.
None of these families have actually won their asylum claim. All of them are in immigration proceedings, and a good number of them are not going to win their asylum claim and are going to face deportation at some date in the future.
The Biden administration is now moving people with MPP cases through multiple ports of entry: Brownsville, El Paso, Laredo, Hidalgo, and San Diego. Eagle Pass, Texas, last week became the sixth port of entry processing MPP cases. So far, they've processed more than 7,000 cases, meaning many thousands more still remain in Mexico. Among them, the Osmani. He's been waiting in Nogales for 2 years.
The government doesn't give you an exact date of when you would be able to enter or when your next court appearance would be or when you have to enter the U.S. to stand in front of a judge. Nothing.
The Osmani and his wife Lidze say they fled political persecution and threats in Cuba and asked for asylum after crossing the U.S. border. Forced to wait in Mexico, he says they faced new threats.
There's organized crime, the mafia, people who assault you, people who rape women, everything. I'm fearful day in and day out. I hardly ever leave my house.
Fearful of staying, the couple tried again to enter the U.S. This time, the Osmani's wife was allowed to stay in the U.S., but he was sent back to Mexico.
In separating me from my wife, allowing her into the U.S. and deporting me, the U.S. doesn't realize that I'm in the same grave danger she is.
While the Osmani waits in Mexico and the border is officially closed, U.S. officials are seeing record numbers of border crossings. According to Customs and Border Protection, that number has been growing rapidly this year to more than 170,000 in March, a 15-year high. Recidivism is high. Most people crossing are single adults, and most are immediately turned back across the border under a pandemic-related rule. But some, like the Osmani's wife, are being allowed to stay in the U.S. and pursue asylum claims.
Whether you enter irregularly between ports or whether you wait and present at a port of entry, you're supposed to have access to asylum. And for the past 2 years, that really hasn't been true.
Alex Miller is managing attorney of the Border Action Team at the Florence Project, a legal services organization based in Arizona. She's working on the Osmani's case, among others.
The ports of entry are closed to the vast majority of asylum seekers in danger in Mexico. What that means then is they see this increase in individuals who are actually succeeding, that are deciding to cross through the desert or over a wall or through rivers and that are actually entering the United States. And they think, okay, well, maybe I should just try. That could be me too.
But the data shows, even though more people in total have been granted asylum in recent years, denial rates have also soared from around 54% in 2016 to a record high 71% by the end of 2020. Numbers reveal the odds of winning an asylum case depend heavily on having a lawyer and country of origin, with those from Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico having the least success. Even as asylum rules have narrowed, the forces causing people to emigrate have only gotten worse.
Things are not going to change until we address them at the root cause.
Democratic Congresswoman Veronica Escobar represents Texas's 16th district, which includes El Paso.
The climate crisis, drugs, criminal activity in neighboring countries, crushing poverty. The more that you close off legal avenues, you're going to see an increase in irregular crossing or undocumented crossing.
Those who make it into the U.S. face another part of the broken system. With so many cases and so few people to process them, it can take years to stand before a judge.
That is part of the brokenness of the system.
Doris Meisner is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute and a former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. She acknowledges why people apply for asylum, but says most claims don't meet the standard.
Those are real reasons for leaving their countries, but for most of them, they are not reasons that ultimately qualify for asylum under U.S. law, under the international definitions. The big need is an asylum system that is fixed in a way that actually makes it possible to make those decisions, but make them in a way that is not only fair, but timely, which means months, not years.
H is now headed to Kansas to stay with her sister. Her son is already there and they'll be reunited soon. After that, she says she doesn't know what will happen.
I hope I will eventually find work. I'm praying to God that I win my asylum case. I have faith that God will help me.
She and her son have made it to the U.S., but whether or not they can stay remains to be seen. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz in El Paso, Texas.
As we reported earlier, the first batch of results from the 2020 census count are in, and the U.S. population topped 331 million last year. The Bureau also released state population numbers, which will reshape the balance of power in the U.S. House of Representatives for the next decade. Lisa Desjardins reports.
Good afternoon.
Rarely is a sedate Zoom call this politically dramatic.
The South grew the fastest over the last decade with a 10.2% increase in population.
With jewel-toned backgrounds, U.S. Census staff announced population shifts that could change the red and blue balance in Congress.
Let's get to the results you've all been waiting for.
The Bureau showed three states in the South have gained enough population to add seats in Congress, Texas gaining two seats, and North Carolina and Florida one apiece. The other three states adding one seat each are West, Colorado, Montana, and Oregon. In turn, seven states will lose one seat each, California, and then a cluster of Rust Belt states, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, and New York. For New York, some sting to the loss. Officials said the state needed to count just 89 more people to keep all of its congressional seats. Reporters triple-checked that.
Wow, that's a big loss for just 89 people.
I can just confirm that the number, when you calculate it, is 89.
This after the census and its army of workers faced a plague of challenges. Coinciding with a once-in-a-century pandemic was just one. The count is as critical as ever. It determines how many seats each state gets in the House of Representatives. And it guides at least $1 trillion to state and local governments for programs like Medicaid, Medicare, school lunches, and more. Hanzi Lo Wong covers the census for NPR.
How big a deal is the announcement today?
This is a very big deal. This is a culmination of really a decade's worth of planning and execution last year. And this is a once a decade reset of the national political map.
Hence the massive drive for responses.
Counting everyone in your home helps support your neighborhood for the next 10 years by funding things like schools, hospitals, and buses.
But like so much in 2020, the census was hit with unprecedented acts of God and man. March 2018, the Trump administration adds a question asking if people are U.S. citizens. Ultimately, the Supreme Court blocks the idea, but it raises confusion and fear in some immigrant communities. January 2019, the partial government shutdown furloughs some census staff during a critical preparation time. March 2020, the coronavirus hits precisely as census forms are mailed out. The agency delays its field operations for almost 2 months. Then September 2020, hurricanes and wildfires across the country hit during the crucial final full month of counting.
The 2020 census was just a mess.
Wong says the layers of issues add to regular questions about undercounted groups, people of color, immigrants, and rural Americans.
For the 2020 census, all of these groups face a higher risk of being undercounted because the Census Bureau was really strapped to try to get door knockers out to communities while there were lockdowns in place, while there were major public health concerns, as well as the Trump administration cutting short the amount of time that door knockers had to reach these households.
Census officials today stood by their count.
We feel very confident that we did a good job of collecting data in spite of the COVID-19 outbreak.
Even so, states that lost, like New York, are sure to be unhappy, along with some states that gained, like Florida, which expected two new seats, not just one. It's too late to add more population, but states do have one option, to appeal these numbers in court. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
And to dive deeper into the political ramifications of the census data released today, I'm joined by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. So hello, Amy. Let's take that deeper dive and tell us a little more about how Democrats, Republicans are affected at the congressional level and then nationally.
Sure. Well, let's start with the winners. On the map, we saw that Texas was the biggest winner, picking up two seats. But you also notice something else here. Republicans have to be happy with the fact that Texas, Florida, and North Carolina all gaining seats. Not only are these states that then President Trump, won in the 2020 election and the 2016 election, but they also are three states that are controlled completely by Republicans. So Republicans control the entire redistricting process in those states that are going to pick up four congressional seats. Democrats you know, Oregon, Colorado, two states that Biden carried, President Biden carried in 2020. That is helpful to them. And then let's go to the losers. We have more states here, seven states that are losing one congressional district. For Democrats, you know, you look at those, some of those big dark blue states, the ones that are the pillars for the Electoral College sort of platform for Democrats to build on. New York, Illinois, California, all those states losing seats, not great for Democrats. Republicans losing a seat in West Virginia, that has become now the most Republican state in the country after Wyoming, and Ohio, a state that used to be a swing state, that's now much more Republican leaning. Overall, though, Judy, if we're looking at the national picture right now, if we put this map into place for in the 2020 election, all right, so everything else remains the same, it would shift just three electoral votes away from Biden toward Trump. So instead of having 306 electoral votes in his victory, it would be 303 electoral votes. It doesn't seem like much, but Judy, when these races now are decided by just such a narrow margin, even one electoral vote can be critical.
Every single one, and one can matter. And Amy, tell us, what about in terms of drawing congressional district lines?
Right.
What are we learning about that?
That's right. This is apportionment. So this is the part where the states learn, did you gain or did you lose a seat? But the real nitty-gritty is going to come later this summer when the detailed data is released to the states and they have to start drawing those lines. That's where you're going to hear words like gerrymander. Even states that aren't gaining or losing, unless you're a state that only has one congressional district, you have to redraw your lines. Population shifted around a lot. Think about a place like Georgia, where the Atlanta suburbs have been booming, not so much in the other parts of the state. So they're going to have to readjust those congressional lines. You can gain or lose a seat as a party just because even if you're not gaining or losing a congressional district, right? The good news for Democrats, they have more control over the process than they did in 2010, the last time the lines were drawn. The bad news for Democrats, the good news for Republicans, is that Republicans still control more than twice as many congressional district lines in terms of they have total control for drawing that many more lines. That's likely to help, as I said, especially in places that are fast growing, Texas, North Carolina, but also in a place like Georgia, where Democrats have made really big gains in these last 2 years, but Republicans control the entire line drawing process. And so what you may see there is Democrats actually winning two Senate seats, but in the next upcoming election, they may lose a congressional district.
So much depends on who controls these state legislatures. Right. Amy Walter, stay with us. We are now going to bring in someone you know very well, NPR's Tamara Keith, joining the conversation for Politics Monday. Hello, Tam. So let's pivot, Tam, from talking about what's coming down the line to what's going on right now, and that is two nights from now, Wednesday night, President Biden making his joint address to Congress as he approaches 100 days in office. I know you've been talking to a lot of people. What are you hearing that people expect him to say Wednesday?
Yeah, and this one is coming a little bit later than these joint addresses traditionally are, which means that President Biden has more accomplishments to talk about, and really his administration held off on scheduling this speech until they were able to pitch the next thing. So this address is certainly going to talk about what has happened, 200 million COVID vaccine shots in arms by 100 days. President Biden will inevitably say that people didn't think it was possible. And, you know, there's still the argument that there was a bit of underpromising and over-delivering. But then they are using this speech and the very big audience that traditionally comes with a joint address to push for the next phase of the infrastructure plan, which isn't really about infrastructure. It's about childcare and families. They're calling it the American Families Plan. So he is going to take advantage of this very big audience to talk about the thing that he and his administration will probably be talking about for the rest of the summer.
And meantime, Amy, this speech comes as we're seeing some new polls about how the president is being seen by the American people. The consensus seems to be that a little more than half approve of the job he's doing. Tell us more about what you see in those numbers.
Yeah, so, you know, President Biden coming into this address with pretty decent approval rating numbers, averaging right now about 54% approval rating. That's a big improvement from, say, where President Trump was at this stage in his presidency. In fact, during the entirety of President Trump's presidency, he never once hit a 50% job approval rating. But it's much lower than previous presidents had seen in this so-called honeymoon phase of the presidency, where you saw folks like even George W. Bush, after a very contentious 2000 election, was looking at approval ratings in the 60s, as was President Obama at this point. And so I think what this tells us is that, you know, this is President Biden won the election with 51, a little over 51% of the vote, his approval rating somewhere around 54%. So basically, he's holding on to everybody that he won in the election and bringing some new folks over. Probably those are not Republicans. Republicans are pretty united in their dislike of the president, but getting independents over to your side, again, in these races that are going to be so critical, 2022, 2024, winning over independents is what brings you from into the W column.
And Tam, you were telling us this is a reminder of how we really are in a different political environment right now.
Yeah, absolutely. As Amy sort of alluded to, former President Trump stayed in a fairly narrow band. He maintained the support of his base. Well, President Biden is, you know, we don't have a lot of data to go for. We're only 100 days in, but he's in a fairly narrow band too so far. He's very near where he was when he won. And it may really truly just be a function of how polarized our politics are now, that even though there's pretty good approval for President Biden's handling of the pandemic, overall, how do you feel about the president? It's pretty locked in. And it's unclear what could change that, because people have really just gone into their corners.
So given that, Amy, what is the space for Republicans to make their case? We know Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina is going to be giving the official Republican response on Wednesday night. What kind of things can they talk about, can they say to make their case?
I think what you're going to hear a lot about from Republicans, we'll see if Senator Scott makes this case as well, is on the issue of immigration. It's the one place when you look at the polling where President Biden is deeply underwater. As Tam said, he's getting really high marks for his handling of coronavirus in the 60s. That's not translating to his overall support. Support on the issue of immigration, really low. That hasn't dragged his numbers down either. But it's clearly a place of weakness for this administration, and I expect to see Republicans talk about that. And then the price tag for all of the spending. I think we're going to hear a lot more about budget deficits. We're going to hear a lot more about, you know, sort of reining in federal spending at a time when Democrats believe that the public is hungry for more investment. And so what Republicans do need to do to make their case that for less funding is to suggest that spending more is both going to raise the deficit, and it also could come at a cost to individuals. The president says no one who's making over $400,000 is going to get taxed. This is all going to come from corporations. I think what you're going to hear from Republicans is saying, yeah, but at some point, that's going to come down to you. Tax cuts or tax increases to businesses end up being increases at, you know, whatever you're buying from that place, eventually it goes to the consumer.
And Tam, just quickly, this is something the White House is prepared for, bracing themselves for?
If you watch the White House press briefing today, they brought in Brian Deese, the DUP economic advisor, to explain why this really isn't a tax increase on regular people or small businesses, that this is really just targeted at even less than the top 1%. So they are aware that this is coming. The other argument that they are prepared for is the argument that, hey, you guys are talking about a lot of things that aren't really infrastructure, which is why this White House has been trying to sort of push the idea that this isn't about infrastructure, but is more about the undergirding of the U.S. economy and things that are needed to create jobs or more fairness. And a lot of these policies are fairly popular in the abstract, and Democrats and the White House are going to have to work to keep them popular while Republicans work to make them less popular or to make people care more about immigration than some of these other things.
So when is infrastructure really infrastructure and when is it really something else? All right. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, so great to have both of you tonight. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Tonight's Brief But Spectacular features Linda Madura, raised in Zimbabwe. She came to the U.S. in 2006, where she studied to become an accountant. She now has her own practice that creates new opportunities for her fellow Zimbabweans back home.
One of the things I've always understood coming to the United States was that Africans have generally been portrayed as basket weavers, coffee bean farmers, but we're more than that. When you look at the grand spectrum of what Africans have been able to do within the United States, they're everything. They're doctors, they're engineers, they're venture capitalists, they're mathematicians. And I really wanted to do my part to change that narrative. I was born and raised in a small mining town in Zimbabwe. I'm the only girl in a family of five. The expectations my parents had for me were very different from the expectations they had for my brother. Their expectations of me were that I would become a good African housewife, I would cook and clean for my family. And I remember the yearning for the books that my brother would get from the library that he never read. In my heart, I knew I wanted to be an accountant. And when I got to school, I snuck away from the fashion and fabrics class and into the accounting class. Somewhere along the line, my parents had realized I was probably just as smart as the boys and wanted to give me the same opportunity as the boys. I am a CPA by profession, and when I first moved to the US, I recall taking weekend classes. I drove every weekend to take extra classes so that I could qualify to sit for the exams. I had a young child. My family was young. We'd just moved to a new city. But within about 2 or 3 years, I'd done enough classes to be able to sit for the exam. And I recall the very long and late hours that my husband, who when I first met, I had told him the most important thing to me in a man is his ability to do laundry. I cannot tell you how valuable that was in those years. My practice, Fifth Avenue Partners, is a back office and CFO solution for venture capital and high net worth individuals. Fifth Avenue Partners was formed in 2017. It's named after a street in the capital, Harare. That street has so many memories for me. I met my husband on Fifth Avenue. I walked down the street on Fifth Avenue to my very first job. Zimbabwe has a very high illiteracy rate. So one of the critical things I wanted to make sure was that whatever we did, the solution we brought to our clients was a cloud-based solution that allows folks in Zimbabwe to work for us and make an honest living. Currently, folks have to work in the middle of the night because that's when reliable electricity is actually available. The thing that breaks my heart the most is the lack of opportunity. There's plenty of women, there's plenty of young girls out there who are smart, who are driven, who have ambition, but they lack the opportunity. What I would say to any girl who feels like maybe their dreams are not heard, maybe no one's listening, ask yourself, what breaks your heart? Because when you can answer that question, I really believe that you will harness everything within you to be able to push yourself to do beyond what you could ever imagine that you could possibly do. As a girl who made it out of a small village of 8,500 people, there's a reason I'm here, and I've got to make sure that I use the opportunities awarded to me to help somebody else who otherwise would never be able to dream of such an opportunity. My name is Linda Madura, and this is my brief but spectacular take on creating opportunities.
Just wonderful. And you can find all of our brief but spectacular segments online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. This past year was no traditional year for the movies or for the Oscar awards. Audience ratings last night were down nearly 60% from what they were in 2020. But there were excellent films, performances, and more diversity in the nominations. Daniel Kaluuya won Best Supporting Actor for his portrayal of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton in Judas and the Black Messiah. Ya Jung-yoon was recognized as Best Supporting Actress for Minari. And Chloe Zhao became the first woman of color to win Best Director for Nomadland. That film won Best Picture and Best Actress for Frances McDormand as well. It focuses on how some Americans are having to scale back and live a minimalist lifestyle on the road. Our economics correspondent Paul Solman reported last fall on what that life is like and spent some time with one of the nomads in the movie. Here's a second look. It's part of his series, Unfinished Business. And a note, portions of the story were shot before the pandemic.
This whole entire industry is just exploding right now.
At Nomadic Customs, Mark Vroman and his crew retrofit vehicles to live in.
I think with the combination of just how things are in the world right now, people are really wanting to jump into vans and buses and just alternative housing situations.
These days, the hashtag van life business is booming. Roman's hired 8 new workers, but still can't keep up.
At last count, I think I had something like 180 estimates to write, probably another 400 emails to return. And yesterday alone, we received 37 phone calls. I feel like I hopped onto a rocket ship and I've just been doing everything I can to hold on.
Pandemic-induced job losses accelerated a desire to escape, which cheap mobile living enables. But lots of folks, many older, were on the road before the van life hashtag. Inspired by this 65-year-old.
Living in nature, wouldn't you like to be out here and see and live like this?
YouTube celeb Bob Wells moved into a van 25 years ago when divorce left him unable to meet the rent in Anchorage, Alaska.
I knew I could live comfortably in a van on $1,400 a month because no house payment, no utility payments. I had solar. I was my own utility company. It worked really well. I enjoyed it. That was the amazing thing.
Enjoyed it so much, in fact, he created a website, cheaprvliving.com, and then a YouTube channel to teach others to downsize and thrive on wheels.
Finding heat in your van is a really important issue for a lot of us. Everything you need to do to stay clean is right here. The topic of today is poop. You can just sit right straight down on a bucket.
Wells' videos, viewed over 80 million times, preach the simple life, especially appealing right now to those ages 55 to 70, some 3 million of whom have been shoved out of the workforce.
25% of Americans don't have a penny saved towards retirement.
Yeah.
So in 5, 10, 20 years, that 25% are going to be living on Social Security, and Social Security won't be enough for them to live on.
Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Every winter in Quartzsite, Arizona, Wells devotees convene at the RTR, the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, for seminars and community.
And it's like a disciple. You're Moses and I'm the disciple. You're spreading the word.
Wells, a self-described introvert, is their celebrity guru.
There's a lot of us here who are on Social Security, and their Social Security is anywhere from $600 to $1,000 a month. And so you can see they couldn't rent a home on that. But when they move into their vans, most of them slowly have to start dipping into their savings, their emergency fund. And so most of them will have to work sometime to replenish it.
So the topic of one RTR huddle, earning on the web.
If you're not monetizing it, meaning you're not making money through your website or social media, then you're kind of missing out.
Well, hello, YouTube family.
Inspired by Wells' success, most people here seem to have a YouTube channel of their own.
We're Camper-Sized Living.
And where can we find you?
YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook.
YouTuber Linda Mastromonaco lives in her SUV, sleeps in the front seat.
I curl up, I stretch out this way, I stretch out this way.
2 years ago, Mastromonaco gave up her apartment, quit the last of her low-paying, no-benefits jobs.
Target, Kroger's, Chico's, all the retail. I have waitressing background. Just all kinds of things where you're on the treadmill, just trying to really literally make ends meet.
She now lives on the road, hawks inspirational cards online, has posted hundreds of videos to her YouTube channel.
I am back on the road.
has over 30,000 subscribers.
More people are feeling stuck right now and making a plan when they can leave.
How's your YouTube channel doing in terms of income?
Income has exploded over the last couple months. I was averaging, you know, $600 a month, and I'm over $2,000 for this month.
Hi, I'm Steve Turtle, and I'm a work camper.
Steve Turtle gives his YouTube followers the down and dirty on work camping, working seasonal jobs while camping, that is.
I want to show you how I clean toilets. Woo-hoo! That's how you clean a South Carolina toilet right there.
Turtle's been hamming it up online for over 2 years.
YouTube rewards you for people watching your videos and the commercial.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Here Carol Meeks has a YouTube cooking channel for nomads on a tight budget.
Some people are living on $500 to $600 a month. So, I mean, we're not going to be having salmon and crab legs. You can do a lot of things for a dollar a serving if you know how to shop, you know, and if you're creative in how you're cooking. I'm planning on becoming the Anthony Bourdain of van life, okay?
You can wash your hair and you got some pressure.
But how many itinerants can support themselves on YouTube earnings like Bob Wells?
For most people, it's not realistic. The idea of making thousands, very few do that.
Consider Steve Turtle's YouTube take.
I was somewhere around 150 a month, and then it sort of fell apart. There was just not a lot going on.
Turtle stopped live streaming when COVID hit.
We are live.
He's back at it, but as of the fall, hadn't reached YouTube's pay threshold.
I don't think I'm going to try to survive off of YouTube.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to my next video.
But if you, like Bob Wells, managed to go viral, pardon the expression,
you make $75,000 a year from YouTube. That's what I read anyway.
I make an amazing amount of money from YouTube.
more than $75,000, I take it.
An amazing amount of money. You wouldn't, yeah. I wouldn't believe it.
Okay, very good.
So
what do you do with the money?
I give it away. What do I need money for? I live in a van.
Indeed, Wells has started a nonprofit to provide homes on wheels for folks in need, in tune with his YouTube channel's goal to lend a helping hand.
I've been devastated in life. In 2011, I have two sons, and one of my sons took his life. That's the only reaction possible. There's nothing like it. It just, how do you express it? Every morning, you wake up and say, how can I be alive on a planet on which he's not here? And so the adequate answer is, I have something to give.
He gives, his followers receive. Carol Meeks' YouTube channel has grown since we first met.
And I actually think that that's been impacted because of COVID, because so many people are looking for entertainment and engagement, and they're doing it online.
Pre-COVID, she was forming friendships with fellow nomads in the flesh. Since the pandemic, strictly virtual bonds.
I have met so many people online and so many other people who have channels who are in this type of lifestyle. So I feel like I have a community.
Carol Meeks, like so many older Americans, seems to have found a new tribe. On the road, online.
Take care, friends.
For the PBS NewsHour, this is Paul Solman.
Such a great report. We wanted you to see it again after all the wins for Nomadland. Thank you, Paul Solman. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.